I wonder, said Frodo, it's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am, delayed. Is it the will of the Dark Tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before, and come down from the north, east of the river and of the Emmon Mule, and so over the heart of Battle Plain to the passes of Mordor. But now it isn't possible for you and me alone to find a way back, and the orcs are prowling on the east bank. Every day that passes is a precious day lost. I am tired, Sam. I don't know what is to be done. The Taming of Smeagol. In this episode of The Grey Company, we will be discussing the evolution of the game we all love. Along the way, we'll talk about the dreaded F-word, fatigue. As dedicated players of the game, how do we avoid getting burnt out on the game? We'll also be taking a look at game design and thinking about how cards, quests, and the meta have developed over the life of Lord of the Rings, the card game. Joining us in this discussion will be a very special guest and one of the developers of the game itself, Matt Newman.
It is the Grey Company Podcast. I'm Derek, and welcome to a very special episode in which we have a crack at the development of the game so far from both a designer perspective and a player perspective. But first, let's get to the introductions. Dan, how have you been since last we chatted?
I've been great. The Austin group is growing yet
again. That's awesome.
So it's exciting to see the game just seems to keep growing in popularity, at least in my area. So yeah, I've had a chance to play quite a bit of Lord of the Rings, four player and also some two player. So it's good.
Excellent. Matthew, how have you been? Is your group still going strong?
It is. I got to play yesterday. It's been a while actually since I played because my work schedule has changed. But I don't remember if I mentioned this on another previous show, but we made like little business cards for the podcast in my local play group, and she's giving them out like hotcakes, and hopefully getting to play with some of those new folks soon. But I've noticed we've had an uptick in likes on our Facebook page from Phoenix area folks. So it's been cool, but yeah, it was fun to play yesterday. I don't really have much else to say.
Cool.
So been all right.
Yeah, the podcasts are really helpful. I know that's the first thing I do whenever I start a new hobby or a new game. I want to go see what else is out there. So I think between us and WWPD and Cardboard of the Rings, there's a lot of resources out there. So it's good to promote that stuff.
Yeah.
Ian, what is up there on the West Coast?
Well, I've kind of had an interesting tale of two weekends. And yesterday I was at a kids' party, a bunch of kids running around. And today is kind of the nerd day doing this podcast and going to play some D&D after this. So
nice. I bet you play a wizard.
No, I'm actually just a straight ahead fighter. So I'm kind of the Matthew character. But the other thing I want to bring up is Dan posted it recently on our Facebook, but on Board Game Geek there's an interesting thread now where people are kind of challenging each other to different scenarios with different heroes, and it's pretty interesting. So if you want to check that out on board, I think it's titled like Player Challenge or something like that.
So it's like the Ice Bucket Challenge, but cool.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So, for example, I've been challenged to beat Redhorn Gate with two Tactics Dominant decks, one of them including Theoden. So, yeah, you can just challenge. Okay.
Is that the one where they're all going to die on the last
Yeah, pretty much. That's why Theoden's there.
Well, not with Theoden. That's the idea, right?
Well, I guess if you wait until the Tactics Aragorn comes out, you put Sword That Was Broken on him. Game over. There you go. That'd be kind of a long time to wait. Anyways, before
it's just a few weeks away.
Several weeks away. Well, speaking several of quote unquote away. Several weeks away, as we said at the top, we have a very special guest this episode. Matt Newman is one of the developers on the game, and we are so thrilled to have him. Matt, welcome to the program. How are you today, sir?
Good, good. Thank you for having me. It's really great to be on the program. I think it's funny that you chose the quote that you chose to kick off the episode because I am tired. It's been a long couple weeks.
Well, as you were sharing before we started recording, it's a good thing that the Game Center has that new coffee shrine, so you can just keep the buzz going. Mm.
That's what my You'd game store needs. I said that yesterday. Mm, after about 2 hours, I was like, I got to call this quits.
Yeah, man. Diet Dr. Pepper does not cut it when you're used to espresso.
Yeah, let me just say that it's not a coincidence that the Austin game group moved from one local game store to another, and the one we moved to happens to serve beer and coffee.
That's what I wish mine had.
So it's, yeah, that was intentional.
If I was to win the lottery, I would open a game store and we would serve those two things. Mm.
No, any beer at the game center?
Oh, yeah, the game center's got beer, it's got wine. Mm-hmm.
Classic.
It's got hard apple cider.
Oh, man.
It's got a lot of stuff. We have our own little... like, you know, baked goods section. Wow. And
man, once we hit that like 10K an episode thing on Patreon, we're all gonna move to the Twin Cities, and we will just put sleeping bags in the game center, and that'll be that.
I'm gonna let you have that conversation with my wife, Derek, and see how that goes. Because good luck. That's all I can say.
We always joke about opening the LCG California branch.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, let's get to it. So as Ian said in the introduction, we're going to be talking about several different things. Basically, the general theme is the life cycle or evolution of the game, and included in that is card design and quest design, but also the idea of fatigue. Any good psychologist will tell you that the first step to addressing a problem is talking about it openly. So we're going to talk a little bit about the idea of fatigue now, but also keep coming back to it as we discuss the game itself and how the game is designed. But what we mean by fatigue is just burnout. We were actually talking a little bit about online RPGs as we were just chatting before we started recording. That's something I've experienced a lot with those kinds of games, where you just play them so much and then it just starts to get a little bit stale. And I think we've all experienced that a little bit with this game and with the various other tabletop games that we've played. But let's talk about that for just a second before we get into the design of the game. So, what have your guys' experiences been with fatigue with this game in particular?
No surprise. I was sort of like, God, I don't want to answer this question because my answer will be obvious, being the curmudgeon of the group. But I've been experiencing it a lot lately, which I think is why I suggested we talk about this. And I played yesterday for the first time in weeks, and then I felt it almost instantly. And as I've sort of reflected on it, I think there's two major sources of it. One is I've been playing my Rumal deck for, God, whenever the hell that Rumal pack came out.
Since like Gen Con?
Yeah, a really, really long time. Yeah. And I just haven't had time to make new decks. So a big part of it is me and the deck building aspect, which can take so long, sorting your physical cards. Like Octagon, I can make a new deck in 10 minutes. And so I get to play lots of different things there. But in person, it's different. The second thing, I think, and this applies to any game, so it's certainly no slight towards LOTR, but at the end of the day, games don't change very much. It's count up your willpower, remember how much you have. If you don't, you count it up again, and then again and again, because you forget what you had, what you said, you know what I mean? And, you know, you count up the threat, and you kill some enemies, and the game is, I mean, the core mechanics of the game are the same, and those don't change. Yeah, there's variations on the theme. You count up willpower, defense strength or attack strength if it's battle or siege or what have you, but the game starts to feel samey. And so I think if you only play one game for so long, no matter what the game is, no matter how much you love it, it's going to start to feel the same no matter what mechanic is sort of slapped on. Sort of the core of it. So, yeah, I've been feeling it lately, but I don't think it's, a problem inherent in the game itself, just as much as I haven't been approaching it with new and interesting decks.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think whenever I hit that point of fatigue, the way to overcome it is to just really try something new. We spent the whole last episode and a half, talking about lore. And it had been a while since I tried a good lore deck, so having so many awesome resources we do online, I found this really cool Grima deck that they posted over at WWPD and Outpost Zero and played that. And I hadn't tried a Doom deck, hadn't tried a lore deck in quite a while, so that kind of thing helps a lot. And having a lot of community resources helps with that a lot, too.
Yeah, I agree. Mixing it up is good. What Ian was talking about, the BGG kind of challenge, or I think they're calling it like the user pose challenge or something like that. But I actually didn't even realize that someone had challenged me until I kind of stumbled across that in the forum. And the two heroes they wanted me to use were Bilbo and Beorn. And So obviously I've made a lot of decks with Daemon, but I hadn't used Bilbo in a very, very long time. And I actually used that as an excuse to make, it was Bilbo and Lore Glorfindel and Eowyn was one of the decks. And the other deck was like just a very, Matthew would love this deck. It was Baragon, Beorn, and Thalon. And it had a ton of direct damage because the quest that they challenged me to do was Watcher in the Water, which again, I hadn't played in, I don't know, years probably. So I had a blast, and I barely won it. One deck threaded out, and the other deck was at 49 when I won. But it's been so long since I used Lord Glorfindel. It's been so long since I played, you know, a lot of those cards or played that quest. And I think this, you know, kind of speaks to what Derek's talking about, is that it was really the most fun I've had playing the game in a long time, just kind of forcing myself out of my comfort zone and just trying something really different. And yeah, I think that's a really key part of the whole you know, fatigue concept, is just mixing it up and not doing the same old same old.
Yeah, I think part and parcel to that is if you play with a relatively stable gaming group, we all tend to play the same kinds of decks, even if we make tweaks at the margin. So my buddy Michael always kind of plays similar decks. Steve, you know, he plays similar sorts of decks. I, of course, almost always play similar sorts of decks. And so even if you change up yours, if your buddies are playing the same sort of stuff, the quests will feel samey. And I also think we always are drawn to the same sort of quests over and over, because if we have the same sorts of decks, they can handle certain kinds of quests, and we don't go back and play Watchers in the Water or something.
I think for me, I haven't felt fatigue in the game lately or for a while. I think I said this in a recent article on Tales from the Cards, but this is the first time with the cycle closing that I feel like there's more deck possibilities than I have time to make them. Part of that may just have to do with not having a lot of free time, but it's also just a reflection of where the card pool is at now, and there's so many different ideas I have, whereas in the past, I think the fatigue was like, well, how many variations of an Eagle or Rohan deck can I make, you know, like there are only so many possibilities. So nowadays, I think the fatigue maybe sometimes is just like more on the content production side of just like keeping up with the articles and this and that. Like, I really enjoy it. But at the same time, you know, when you're doing it week in and week out, it does, you know, you have to guard against it feeling like a job and ever turning into that instead of feeling fun anymore. So far, it's still on the side more of feeling fun, but there are times when it leads to fatigue. But as far as the game itself part, I haven't felt burnout with it in a while.
I'll definitely second that as a content creator. It can be hard sometimes to get the articles out when there's so many other things pressing for your time.
Yeah. Just quit your job, Dan.
We're all very appreciative of it.
Thanks.
Thank you guys. A great job.
So Matt, what about you? I can't imagine. I mean, you do this for a living, and so you not only are playing with the current card pool, secret future card pool, doing this stuff all day, every day, I would assume. How do you prevent just getting sick and tired of counting up your willpower?
Well, I think there's two important factors that help on my side.
Paycheck?
One is it probably does. No, well, I mean, I think I get asked a similar question a lot about, you know, how do you prevent this from feeling too much like a job? And you know, it helps that I really, really enjoy the game as a whole, but just always having, I always have new projects to work on, and that's, you know, obviously that's something that I can say is helpful on my end, not maybe necessarily for other people, but it just really helps me, because if I start getting tired of something, I can always switch to a different project, switch to a different deck, and there's always something for me to be testing out. So that helps a lot. But one thing that I do that any player can do is, and I do this almost as a challenge to myself, but it really helps keep things fresh, is every several weeks or so, I just deconstruct all of my decks. I just put all of them away and start fresh and build a whole bunch of new decks. And obviously it's very time consuming, but it can be very helpful, because sometimes you find new interactions that you would have never thought of. You go to heroes that you haven't used before, and it really helps keep things fresh and interesting, because you can play the same quest 8 or 9 times. If using a different deck every time, it's going to feel like a different experience.
Right.
That's great, because if you do keep them together, then we're talking about this on Twitter a little bit this week. The temptation is to say, well, I've already got these decks put together. I don't have a lot of time. Let's just play the same one. So if you tear them down, then you force yourself to do something new. That's good advice.
It helps, because I know some people keep a slew of, you know, 6 to 8 decks built, and that's great when you're playing every now and then and you just have you know, this sort of booklet of decks that you can choose from at any given moment. But I think it's better if you have a small variety of decks, maybe 2 to 4 decks, you know, enough that you could give people decks if you're playing with strangers or people you've never met before, but then deconstruct those decks every now and then and create 4 more.
Yeah, that kind of makes me think of, I kind of talked about how blog kind of running this, the blog that I do, contributes to fatigue, but it also combats it in a way, in a similar way, in that it, I kind of feel an obligation. I don't know if obligation is the right word, but I feel like, you know, I need article ideas, so I need to build a new deck, so I have something to talk about, you know, or like, I'm going to write an article about this concept, so I need to build a deck that tests that. So in a way, it kind of helps the game feel fresh for me, and that I'm constantly like feeling like it pushes me to explore new parts of the game and new decks that I probably wouldn't otherwise. So I'm not sure if everyone out there has the time or wants to start a blog, but I think there are ways that you can kind of push yourself to do similar things by setting challenges for yourself, or, you know, picking one card to build a deck around and that kind of thing.
I honestly think the best thing that any player can do, and, you know, obviously this isn't something that everyone can do depending on where you live and your location and that sort of thing, but is to go out and meet new people, meet new players, and play mm-hmm. with people that you've never met before. Because honestly, the social aspect of this game is mm-hmm. one of the best parts, and that's what's going to keep it really fresh, is meeting new faces and playing with people that you've never played with before.
Yeah, I remember, it's been a while, but someone posted a deck with Spirit Pippin early on in the life of our podcast, and I remember going down to Tucson and playing with Matt H., and I was playing the Pippin deck, and he played, I think the other one was a Dunehir deck, because Pippin pushes him back to the staging area or whatever. And it was fun. I mean, you know, I didn't love it. I'm still not a huge fan of Spirit Pippin, but it was fun to play something different. And Dan, when I sort of did a modified version of your location control deck for our little trek through the old forest the other day, it was fun to do something different and use, you know, heroes that I don't typically use. And I totally agree. That's a way to keep things kind of exciting.
Well, we're talking about the evolution of the game today, and a great place to start is by looking at what goes into designing a card. And we'll begin by looking at player cards. Now, obviously, we want to hear from our special guest, but also we've all dabbled with and thought about player card design, so we'll all chime in here. But when thinking about player card design, some of the key factors that will go into it would be balance, balancing it out with the rest of the card pool, and even balancing it with theme, I would say. And that's the second thing to think about, fun and theme, but also complexity. We spent a lot of time on our wrap-up of the Ringmaker cycle discussing that. How complex is too complex, either for individual cards or for quests themselves. So thinking about player cards, what are you guys' thoughts on those kind of three aspects? How do you balance a card? How do you make it fun? And how complex is too complex?
Well, I guess I'll kick it off. Generally, I'll say that we generally try to think of an effect and kind of work from there. You know, each individual card will have a theme already sort of specified for that card. So like, this is going to be a Dunedain Ranger, he's going to be Spirit, something along those lines. And then we'll try to think of effects that, you know, work with the theme of the cycle that we're going with, or we'll try to think of an effect that works off of those existing themes, like what's a good Spirit card, what's a good Dunedain card, that kind of thing. And we'll usually just work from there and play it a few times, see if it's too weak, too good, and we'll just keep making adjustments. I mean, any given card will go through many, many, many different iterations over the course of playtesting a cycle.
When you say try it out, let's say you're talking about the example of a Spirit Dunedain Ranger. Would you just say print out a proxy of that card, throw it in a Spirit deck you've already got, and then just try it out? Or what's kind of maybe the specifics of trying that card out as you're developing it?
I guess it depends on what point in the process we're at. Early on, I'll try to build a deck with as many sort of early iterations of card designs as I can, and just see which ones stick and which ones don't. And the ones that don't, I might just change them right then and there, or I'll hand it off to Caleb. I'm lucky enough that I sit right next to Caleb, so I can just throw a card at him, sometimes literally, and see what he thinks about it. And sometimes he'll bring up a good point about, I don't think that this is very good. Or he'll say, That's way too good. That doesn't happen very often. But, you know.
Well,
we always have things that we're worried about balance-wise.
Well, yeah, that was going to be kind of my next question when we're talking about balance. Are you consciously thinking about, in Shadows of Mirkwood, we saw cars that were like this. This is going to totally wreck that. Or does that just come out naturally as you're playtesting it?
It's a little of both. Okay. I tend to have an encyclopedic knowledge of some cards, especially earlier cards, because I started this game when it first came out, so it's very sort of near and dear to me. But definitely the hardest part of balancing an individual card is identifying the combinations that drastically alter that card's power level. You might have a card that, in a vacuum, is perfectly fine, maybe even not that good, but when combined with all these other cards, it suddenly becomes way better than intended. So that's something that we're always on the lookout for.
Well, Zigil Miner's probably a great example of that, where if, you know, without scrying, that card probably wouldn't be played all that much, but then when you have Imladris going in almost every spirit deck, suddenly it starts to become too powerful the way it was originally designed.
Yeah, that's definitely a potential example. I think another example would be something like Born Aloft, where when that card came out in the Mirkwood cycle, Born Aloft, okay, yeah, sure, zero cost attachment, it's good, it's got some uses, it's not game breaking or anything, but then people find ways to use that to recycle a certain card's response effect when they enter play over and over and over and over and over again, and that's not something that we want.
Now, Ian, you design your player cards almost in a vacuum. Obviously, they interacted with some of the pre-existing player cards, but when you found that you were developing your first age expansion, did you find that it was maybe slightly easier because you kind of had this limited card pool? Because obviously we're not going to have Thalin or Gimli or Dying Ironfoot in the first age. So what was your experience with that to kind of contrast Matt's experience dealing with the whole card pool?
Yeah, in a way, it was kind of the theme aspect was a good cop-out, and that I could just say, well, these characters aren't here, so I don't have to bother with them. And I even put in there, little caveat, like, this expansion is not intended to work with all these cards, because, having to balance, like, however many cards, new player cards I made with the existing player cards was just mind-boggling, right. And It's definitely the job that you guys do as designers must be tough, because having to take all that into account. But even with just the player cards I was designing, it's tough because designing scenarios, I think, your own fan custom scenarios is an easier job in a lot of ways, because you can kind of create a nice scenario that works consistently with each other. But designing a set of player cards that are balanced and work with those scenarios is a much tougher job, I think, and that was the bigger challenge I had.
Well, we're also very lucky in that we have a crew of very dedicated and very skilled playtesters that are able to identify all kinds of combos between different player cards, and also interactions between some new player cards and older scenarios that we may not have considered. That we then have to go, we should probably not do that. Yeah, they're very good at identifying that kind of thing.
Thinking about scenario design, one thing I'd like you to talk about, if you don't mind, is the Road Darkened scenarios. Those are singular sets. They're not made up of multiple sets like most of the other quests are. So did that present a little bit of freedom when you were designing those Road Darkened quests? Or how did that play out? Because even with the Black Riders, you had a couple different sets that mixed in to make the encounter deck.
Mm-hmm. It mostly stemmed from just examining the three scenarios. The first thing that we do whenever we're working on a cycle is we map out the entire cycle ahead of time. We have to, in order to craft the encounter sets that are going to be in the deluxe box. But when we were working on the Road Darkens, the first thing Caleb said, the very first thing was, these aren't going to have encounter sets. There's just no way. These scenarios are too different from one another, and there's really no themes that carry over from one to the other that we can really flesh out and expand upon. There are no enemies that carry over from one another. They're in completely drastic different locations. We could have maybe created a treachery set or something, but it would have been very kind of weak thematically. So very early on, he decided no encounter sets, and I think it worked very, very much in that box's favor, because we did have some freedom to explore the quest the way the quest was meant to be. But we definitely, I really like the encounter set structure. I love that as you're playing through a cycle, you'll see certain cards over and over again. You kind of get to identify with them.
Yeah.
And you get to really kind of understand how to beat that card over the course of many scenarios. The first time you see it, you're like, oh, you know, it's this Dunlending, Berserker. He attacks every time I draw a card. Wow, that's interesting. But then after you play through the entire cycle, you get to the Antlered Crown, and then the Antlered Crown serves as a sort of test of everything you've learned up until that point. And that's something that I think I really like.
Yeah, I definitely grew to hate certain cards over the Ringmaker cycle. I will not deny that. I really like the general trend you guys did with a lot of the treacheries where you gave a choice. I think that choice is really interesting. You know, do one damage to each exhausted character or remove a time counter is like, it leads to a lot of strategy, and you can build decks around knowing, okay, I've got a lot of healing, so I'm always going to choose to take the damage, or I'm not running healing, and I have some way of dealing with whatever the time effect is, so I'm going to always remove the time counter, and you can kind of like even plan accordingly, I think is really interesting.
And does that factor into player card design? Because as you said, you map out the entire cycle as you go, so I guess is that a chicken and the egg type question? Do you say we're going to have these kinds of encounter sets focusing on these mechanics, and so we're going to design some player cards to deal with that? Because thinking back in the Ringmaker cycle, there weren't too many cards that necessarily directly combated the kinds of things that we were faced with in the encounter set. So how are those two things kind of done in tandem, or is it just depend?
I think I would say they're typically parallel lines that don't necessarily intersect. Sometimes they do, and it's a convenient incidental bonus when they do, but most of the time we map out the quests for a cycle, and then we'll map out the player cards in a sort of major overarching themes. You know, what traits do we want to explore, what spheres are going to get which themes, and that sort of thing. And for Ringmaker, for example, it was obviously Sylvan's, also focus on individual traits and kind of going back to some earlier things that is a way to keep older decks fresh, like Gwaihir, for example. So those were just the major themes of the Ringmaker cycle. They didn't necessarily intersect with the quests.
Those are a lot of times some of my favorite cards, those when you kind of have the one-off. Like, I really have enjoyed putting Gwaihir back in my older Eagle decks, and I like that you guys do that.
Yeah, and keeping in tandem with the theme of the episode, that's one thing that we do to combat player fatigue, is if we see that people aren't using a certain deck type anymore because it's been a long time since a new card has come out for it, we'll throw them a bone, and you'll get something like Gwaihir, the new secrecy cards, for example. And it really helps kind of keep things fresh because you want to go back and revisit those decks.
Yeah. One thing we discussed a lot, or I noticed we've been discussing quite a lot in the last few episodes, is dealing with scaling. You talked about your playtesters. Do you get complaints about the scaling, or do you guys find that, is it working the way you want it to? In other words, is a four-player game meant to take considerably longer and be considerably more difficult, or is that something that's still being tweaked? Just because it's really only been in the last few months since my local group has picked up that I've come to see the contrast between playing solo and two-player versus three and four-player.
I would say there's no hard and fast rule here, but
okay.
I think one thing that we do note, I mean, we know when one quest is going to be way harder with a single player, way harder with four players, or anything in between there. It's something that we always take note of. We don't always necessarily take action on it, because I think that that's something that adds to the personality of that quest, and it kind of helps generate a pool of quests that are vastly different from one another. If one quest is particularly hard for four players, and another quest is particularly hard for a single player, that just kind of adds to your own decision-making when you want to decide what quest to play. You can sort of take that into account. Do I want to play a really hard scenario? Do I want to play something where we, as a four-player group, can steamroll it? You know, not necessarily something that you'd want to do, but, you know. So it's something that we're aware of.
I'll say it does speak to fatigue as well, because if you know that quest X is going to be like a 2-hour walk through the dead marshes. I don't mean dead marshes specifically, but feel like a walk through the dead marshes four player. And that's not what you're looking for that day. Then it does provide you with some options, provided you understand, you know the quests well enough to do that. So
I mean, yeah. we'll do our best to make sure that it's not unfun. That is certainly something that we're on the lookout for. But a four-player game is always going to take longer simply because there's four players. That's sort of unavoidable.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned steamrolling, because my local play group, we have basically, we've been playing three or four-player games almost exclusively. And we have basically been losing legitimately every quest for 3-4 months now. Maybe not quite 4 months, but for a very long time. And that gets old. You're like, oh my god, I just spent 2 hours on this quest and we lose due to whatever factor. So yesterday, and I always joke Passage Through Mirkwood, but we never actually play Passage Through Mirkwood. But yesterday, I said, all right guys, I have to leave by 4:30. So we played Antlered Crown, lost. And then I was like, all right dudes, we gotta win. What are we picking? And because it's been months since we've won. And so we played Conflict at the Carrick. And then Celeborn died to a stupid sack. But we still won. Oh, no. We still won. And so, but yeah, we got it. Sorry, we got to go to an older quest that we think we can steamroll. And we didn't quite steamroll it, but we won. So
yeah, it's fine. The same thing happens with us. Is sometimes steamrolling is good, because after you've, you know, played a couple and, you know, either get, sometimes you get blown out early, or other times it's, you know, a long, slow descent into destruction. Yes. And then at the end you're like, okay, it's time for a palate cleanser, and we're going to go with something easy that we can crush.
It's so true. And I'm starting to see the common denominator is me, because all of our Twitch videos we lose, my local playgroup are losing. I'm thinking, well, the only common thing here is me. So maybe I'm just a crappy player or bad at picking quests. I don't know. But I'm glad I finally can say I have a victory.
I guess to sort of close out that player discussion, one thing that we always look at is we try to design the scenario to be as fun as it can be within the mechanics of that scenario. So if a scenario is all about, for example, the Three Trials is all about fighting these guardian enemies, and there's always going to be one in play, and at the end we wanted all three of them to come back, we knew that that was going to make things tougher for a solo player, and that a four-player group was going to have an easier time because they could sort of split those guardians up between them, and it would be easier for them to take them on instead of a solo player getting all three. And that's just sort of inherent to that scenario's design. And we'll include some ways to combat that using stuff like Doomed, which is a tougher keyword when there's more players, because it's harder to reduce four players' threat than it is to just reduce one player's threat. And we'll use that as a way of trying to negate that, but sometimes we just go with the flow.
One of the interesting things I've found in terms of scaling, because I want to echo Matthew's sentiments, is like our group, as it's gotten larger, we're playing more and more four-player games just because there's enough people there that that's really the best way to break it up, and there's only so many tables. But I've noticed that as far as the Ringmaker cycle, there a lot of the scenarios are really hard four-player, and I think it honestly comes down to the time mechanic, which is a really interesting mechanic, and I think it works in the scenarios that I really like out of the cycle. I think it works really, really well. But one of the things I've noticed in four player that makes it super challenging, even if everyone's kind of bringing like their A deck to the table, is just that with four plus cards around and a lot of those effects potentially removing time counters, and some of these scenarios will only have like time two or time three, you can get like first turn blowouts actually on certain quests where you're pretty much like done round one or round two. And whereas in a solo, you're just not going to see those cards, you know, enough cards quickly enough to really put you in that dire of a situation so early. So it's just interesting to see like the scaling. I think the scaling definitely does depend on the mechanics in terms of how well it scales or how consistently it scales for multiplayer. And I feel like time is one of those ones that can be kind of, can wildly fluctuate, at least in my experience with the four-player games. Whereas like the solo and the two-player seem to be a bit more consistent the way the scenarios feel or play.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that helps when there's four players is that just means that there's essentially more tools in the player's tool belt to combat certain situations. You have more copies of a test of will between all of you, you know, provided anyone's playing Spirit. More location control, more ways to take care of enemies, direct damage, that sort of thing. So that helps to sort of balance it out, but naturally there's going to be a lot more synergy between the encounter cards when there's more reveals on each turn.
Yeah, one of the things I was curious about is just, I guess, deciding how difficult a particular quest is going to be. Like, I feel like in kind of the deluxe expansions, you have three quests you can kind of figure out a good trajectory. But when you're going through a whole cycle, like, is it just a matter of, you know, thinking, you know, let's throw a few easy ones, a few hard ones, or is it like, let's get progressively harder, or just does it just depend on the quest and the theme and kind of how it develops organically?
That's a really good question. I would say that typically we don't decide on how difficult a quest is going to be until later, until far later, once the scenario is basically done. Because what we tend to do is we think of what would be a fun quest, what would be a fresh and interesting quest, what would be a quest that fits our story really well, and kind of work from there. And if it just so happens that that quest is really difficult, then that's a really difficult quest. Here's an example, the Dunlin Trap. We never intended to open up the cycle with a quest that's very difficult, but when developing that quest, it turns out that the best way, we wanted to evoke this feeling of you're being ambushed, you're led into a trap. These Dunlendings are surrounding you and you're just getting relentlessly attacked. And if the quest ended up being that every turn you would clear the staging area and the enemies aren't really that tough, you're not really getting that feeling of being ambushed. So it was important to us that that quest be very relentless.
Well, mission accomplished, because I think we all felt ambushed when that pack came out, and it should feel that way. We play the One Ring role playing game, and if you're lost in Mirkwood, it's not supposed to feel fun. The experience of it could be fun, and getting out is fun, but it's freaking Mirkwood. And by the same token, you know, you're getting ambushed by Dunlendings. It should not feel like a picnic in the Shire. So you guys have done well in terms of evoking those feelings.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. We're about to start a One Ring campaign up in Minnesota.
Get honey cakes.
Honey cakes.
Bjorning honey cakes. It's a lifesaver. Right.
I don't have a good segue for this question, but it's something that we have been talking about probably in every episode for the past 2 or 3 months, and that's locations, which sort of came up a moment ago. And, you know, I have said or felt for a long time that the travel, I think I probably even said this in progression series videos or something, but that the travel phase of the game is the least fun, it's the least exciting, sort of the least, I don't want to say least consequential, because there can be good decisions, but of all the phases of the game, it's the least exciting. And when you're playing four-player games, like we were playing AntlerCon yesterday, and legit 2 turns in a row, bad shuffling, we revealed 4 locations. And at that point, you're just like, nope, this stuff is over. Because there just isn't a way to deal with that in a four-player game. You can have all the little horsies that you pop in the world, but that can't clear most locations now because they have 5 quest points or something. So is that something you guys are aware of? I know you can't spoil anything, but can we maybe have some hope in the future that locations won't be so bad in multiplayer? Or I'm not really sure what my question is, other than I just sort of want to hear your thoughts on how locations are just so difficult to manage, unlike, I think, other aspects of the encounter deck.
Sure. Well, I mean, we're never going to abandon location control as a concept in player cards. There's always going to be new ones. I obviously can't tell you exactly what cards are coming out, but there's always going to be new cards to combat locations. But it's also a tough balance because, you're right, it's more of an issue in a multiplayer game, and we don't want to run into the sort of issue where somebody creates a deck using these player cards that we've made that completely makes locations not an issue at all in a 1 or 2 player game. That would be probably a bad design. But I think it's important for the game, and it's something that we always think about when we're creating actual locations, that the travel phase create interesting decisions. It's less so in a 1 or 2 player game because there's less locations coming out, but in a 3 or 4 player game, you're always going to have this decision of which location do we travel to, and we want to make that decision as difficult as possible and make the discussion that players have around the table very, very dynamic and interesting based on their situation. And if it ends up that, you know, and every now and then this will happen, but if it ends up that the travel phase is, well, let's go to this one because that's the obvious choice, then that's not as fun as, ooh, these are both really bad for us. Which one do we go to? You know what I mean? Or these are both really good for us. Which one do we go to? Yeah. And I think you'll see more of that, I think, as we become more proficient in creating encounter decks. And as the game goes on, there'll be better ways to deal with them. But more importantly, it'll be more fun.
Yeah, and I will definitely say that that has happened. Playing Antlered Crown and then Conflict of the Carrick yesterday, it's just night and day, the difference between the travel phases. In older quests, you either ask Velothet away, or Warden of Arnor takes care of it because it only has one quest point, or the locations don't do anything to you, whereas in Antlered Crown or the newer stuff, it's like, oh, crap. I mean, they all do something, most of which are bad, or if they're good, they're only one quest point, so, you know, it's not going to be good for long. So I will definitely say the decision part has gotten a lot better, but I guess just dealing with the sheer number of them is more of the issue now than are there interesting decisions to make.
Yeah, that's absolutely been my experience in our local play group. Is I really like that there are there's a lot more decision making in the travel phase, and I like that there's some new, like a great one that we experienced yesterday is it was to catch an orc, and there's a location that while it's active, no time counters can be removed from the current quest, I want to say. And so there's really great strategy around, okay, we're going to go there this turn, we're going to engage a bunch of enemies that have forced effects that ordinarily would be removing time counters. Like, it's great that you can have some really deep strategy around that. The one thing that I would say, though, in the four-player games is I pretty much feel like at this point, with any of the newer quests, if someone isn't running Northern Tracker plus Asphaloth plus maybe Warden or some of the Rittermark's Finest or whatever, like a plethora of location control options, that we have a really good chance of just getting location locked and losing. And that's something that I definitely see as kind of being more concerning as the game goes on, as I feel like now there's less creativity in a four-player game in terms of what decks people can bring to the table. I really, like, I almost feel like a jerk with some of the newer players being like, okay, here's the deal. Someone's got to bring Eowyn. We need to have at least two players bring Spirit with as many copies of Testawil as you've got. Someone's got to have Glorfindel and Asphaloth. Someone needs to be running Heavy Spirit so they can do Northern Trackers. Like, and it just... It sucks to be that way, but I almost kind of know going in, when I look around the table and realize, okay, only one person's got Spirit and they've only got one Spirit hero, we're probably about to get destroyed.
Yeah. I wonder if side quests are going to help. Well, I wonder. It seems like side quests are going to help with that a bit in terms of easing things up and maybe providing some other options for travel and questing.
Side quests are sort of an added layer.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Instead of just having all these locations, the side quests might change it up. You know, we're talking about fatigue, so I think side quests, it seems, I know you can't talk too much about it, but it seems like it will add some differentiation.
They definitely passed the feel test for me. Just seeing them, it just makes me think of, like, you know, when you read Tolkien, you know, there's times when, you know, the dwarves are going to go on to Erebor, and Gandalf has to go off and do his own thing. And it just really, like, it fits thematically that you would have times when you take a detour, right?
Definitely. Well, let's go on and talk a little bit about the evolution of the game directly in the ways that it has grown from the core cycle to the Ringmaker cycle. So let's talk about specifically the Ringmaker cycle and how it differs from older cycles. I think there's definitely a marked change in the game as it has naturally developed, but especially with Matt, you and Caleb at the helm. It seems like you guys have a very clear vision about what you want the game to do. So let's start by talking about traits. One of the objectives that was laid out when the cycle began was that this batch of player cards was going to kind of punch up and smooth over some of the different traits that were presented earlier in the game that maybe needed some lovin'. So let's start with talking about some of the traits that have gotten specific attention in this cycle from you guys. Why don't we start with everybody's favorite and talk about Sylvan for a minute?
Well, I think the Sylvan really represent kind of how traits have developed, and that they've probably, out of the traits we've seen get a good deal of attention all at once, they feel the most balanced. You see, like, the dwarves and outlands, it was just like, whoa, you know, big punch in your face. And maybe that reflected where the game was at that moment, that you needed that big dose of power for players to combat. You know, I remember in the early part of the game, everything was just so difficult. So maybe we're just at a point in the game's life where we can have more balance, but it definitely, the Sylvan feels fun, it feels powerful, but it doesn't feel, like, too over the top.
Yeah, my thought was that the traits in the game in general are more complex, which is something we talked about in a previous episode, the complexity and how, whether it's board state or player cards. And Ian, you pretty much echoed my thought, or I'm echoing your thought, which I was thinking, which is that, you know, dwarves and dwarves and outlands, you're right, they were not subtle. really. And partly the dwarves got a lot of bonus because of the Hobbit sagas, which I think we all tend to sort of gloss over. If it had just been Khazad-dûm and the Dwarf cycle, they wouldn't be nearly where they are, but the Hobbit's all about 13 dwarves, and that really exploded them in ways that other traits haven't had that sort of love. But with that said, it's just sort of gross, swarm your armies of dwarves. Same thing with Outlands. Whereas Sylvan is a little more tricksy in that you almost... it's more complicated, I think, to play them because you actually don't want them on the table, which has some benefits with those fun events, but it's also really risky to have just your three heroes on the table because you popped your allies back to your hand or whatever. So I think they're much more subtle in their power, and maybe it requires a higher level of play style or player to utilize them effectively, whereas Outlands sort of play themselves.
I agree with that. I think that Dwarves and Outlands were a lot more straightforward. Dwarves less so. But Sylvan provide a lot of options. So when you say complexity, I think of options. And it was really fun to build a Sylvan deck and present it to my friend, who is a very smart player, knows the game really well, but he doesn't collect it because I buy everything, so why would he want to spend all the money? So when I make the deck for him and I gave it to him, it was fun to see kind of the lights come on in his brain as he was playing. He's like flipping through his hand going, oh. And so... to me, that speaks to how the Sylvan trait has been fleshed out, and it's thematically appropriate too, because the elves are quite tricksy in their ways. So it's nice to see that develop. Whereas in previous cycles, especially the Shadow of Mirkwood, where we first kind of get introduced to them, they seem kind of flat and piecemeal.
I actually have a question for Matt in regards to traits. I'm wondering if. You chose to have Nalir be the most obnoxious objective ally ever created because dwarves in the past were such a strong archetype. It was like a way of kind of counterbalancing that.
That's funny.
No. He was purely a story element. I mean, he's a very roguish character, and you never really quite know if you can trust him. Is he telling the truth? I don't know. He's kind of he's very what's the word?
Shifty.
Well, I mean, if you're reading the story text, he's kind of annoying, and he's not really on your side. He's kind of out for himself. So it just kind of made a lot of sense to us when you're running around Tharbad trying to keep quiet. He's you know, knocking stuff over, raising your threat, accidentally showing yourself to the enemy, and we just really liked that interaction.
Oh, you guys nailed it from a narrative standpoint. But let me just say, our local playgroup, we have a few nicknames for him that I cannot repeat right now.
Yeah, I will say he's fun with Dane because then he quests for two. So at least, you know, he wasn't quite so bad.
That's fine.
Or one, I forget. Whatever it was, I enjoyed having Dane.
I think he's if I remember correctly,
he might be 0-1. But hey, we got something out of him. So
yeah.
I always make a point of blocking a weaker enemy with him when possible, especially if I have Shadow Cancellation, because I'm like, man, you're going to be useful for something in this game. He's got to pull his weight.
Stupid dwarf.
He's attacking for two if you have Dane.
That's true.
So speaking of traits, what is it that you and Caleb are most concerned with? Would you rather see traits developed and be strong, or is there still sort of this focus on the spheres and there should be a melding of various traits? Because it seems like the people in the forums and the player base, at least the outspoken internet player base, they want pure theme decks. Which spheres in and of themselves don't lend themselves to theme, because you could just put all the spirit dudes in a deck and have a really probably pretty solid deck. But players seem to want to gravitate, or at least a sizable portion of the player base wants to gravitate towards theme, or traits, I should say. Traits, themes, almost synonymous, versus the spheres themselves.
Sure. I think it sort of, there are two different sort of ways of looking at the player card pool. And what we want to do is sort of support both of them simultaneously. So when we design a card that's like a Gondor leadership card, we'll say, does he fit within leadership? And then we'll also say, does he fit within Gondor's playstyle? And if he doesn't fit within both, we'll try to find a way to fit him within both, you know, for the traits that have been fleshed out. So, because I think early on in the game's inception, and I wasn't hired at the time, so I can't necessarily say with 100% certainty, but I know for a fact that early on in the game's design, it was important for it to feel like a fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely, and you know, you get that from the core set. You open it up, and none of the heroes are really quite alike. So you feel like you've created this fellowship of very differing people from different backgrounds and whatnot. And it's the spheres that really unite them. But I think we found over time that players really like to make thematic decks, and you know, I really want to make a deck with all Gondor. I really want to make a deck with all elves. I really want to make a deck with all dwarves, and that's something that people really like. So we want to make sure that that's also a possibility. And every new cycle, we're experimenting with different things. You know, with the Against the Shadow cycle, we experimented with Monosphere. We're also experimenting now with different traits. You know, we have cards like attached to a Ranger hero, attached to a Noble hero. Those are traits that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say, I'm going to make a noble deck, but you probably could now with all the cards that we have.
It's interesting.
Well, since we're talking about traits, I would feel remiss if I didn't bring up Ents, because I love Ents so much. And so the Ents speak to something I've been thinking about as far as, you know, when I was designing my own custom cards, about like this balance between complexity and abstraction, because the Ents are kind of this interesting force, you know, that are take a while to get going. And so I can imagine an Ent design where it was very complex and they had like all these different effects on them, you know, a whole paragraph on each card that explains how the conditions under which they get into play, right? And you guys went for a very simple approach, which is they're just very low-costed for good stats. And at first, to be honest, I wasn't sure what I thought about it. I'm like, you know, two attack, that's like Legolas is stronger than an Ent. Right. And then now the Antlered Crown came out and I got a chance to play with them, I really appreciated how the Ents are designed, and that, you know, when I'm getting my booming Ent up to like six attack and just demolishing everything, I'm like, okay, this is an Ent. So I just feel like... From a player perspective and my own little amateur dabbling in design, I've come to appreciate abstraction in designing these cards, that it can be your friend, that you can accomplish a lot with just one little game effect if it's well designed to kind of connect with theme and do what you want to do.
Yeah, I think Caleb put out a really good article a few months ago about thematic considerations and how we as designers and as players have to sort of appreciate a certain level of abstraction just to make the game work and to make the game keep moving forward at like a steady pace. Because if we were going to build Ents to be really 100% spot on to the way they are in the books, they'd probably take multiple rounds to ready. They would. Right. They'd have like the time.
Yeah, I was going to say we should have time.
It would just take a really long time. Someone brought that up actually early on in playtesting. Like, oh, you should use the time keyword. And in addition to it not comboing well with the encounter deck, consistently trying to remove time, it kind of created an unfun play state where you just had all these guys out and you couldn't use them. And granted, that was the point, but it wouldn't be fun. Losing them for one turn is already a pretty heavy restriction. And on the flip side, we also could have made them, you know, running around with like 8 strength and 6 willpower and 6 defense and 12 hit points, but it just would not have really fit the game, you know?
It seems to be a pro and a con when dealing with gaming in Middle Earth, because you have these inherent restrictions with the lore, whatever you want to call it, the source material. It also kind of, I should think, forces you to be a little bit creative in how you implement it. And that kind of sounds like that was your approach with the Ents as a particular thing.
Yeah, and the truth is we weren't even sure how much, you know, at first, if we were going to even do Ents, because we were like, how are we going to do Ents, man? They're huge. And we talked about it for a really long time before we settled on the idea that we came up with, which I think works really well.
Yeah.
And players just have to sort of appreciate that level of abstraction with the stats. Because 3 defense doesn't necessarily mean that you are so inherently tough that you can just take these attacks. I mean, look at like Denethor with 3 defense. He's the Steward of Gondor. But it can represent other things as well. It could just represent an innate skill or experience, wisdom, that kind of thing. But anyway, and the same thing goes for enemies. When you see an enemy engage you and it's got 5 attack, you're like, how's this guy double the attack of Legolas or something?
Right.
On a somewhat related note, we started off this segment with talking about the evolution of the game, and, you know, my first thought was, well, the modern cards in many ways invalidate the earlier ones, and not always the case, but generally speaking. So the first one I thought of was the Galadrin Archer, whatever it's called. It's pretty good stats. It does a damage, and you compare it to the for one cost. Now it only has one hit point, to be sure, but you compare it to the poor little Rohan archer who costs three and does nothing special, right? It's almost like, ugh. And then now we're talking about the Ents, and I think everyone's first comparison was Radagast, who cost five, and his stats are 2-1-1-3 for a very similar effect to Treebeard, who costs less and has way better stats. So, I mean, how much do you think, all right, we're making this elven range character with way better stats and costs less than the core set dude who did, I don't know, Veteran Axe Hand or something? Like, is that something you think about, or do you just sort of accept that that was the first expansion of the beginning of the game and things are inherently going to be weaker and cost more?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that cards near the beginning are going to be weaker, because I think there are some really stable cards, even just in the core set and in the first cycle, that will really carry decks forward for a long time to come. Yeah. But I guess it's important, I would say it's important to see each card, not just comparing those two cards, but also, you know, in a deck as a whole. Like Treebeard and Radagast is kind of a tough comparison because, yeah, Radagast is one cost higher and he just has so much less stats, but you're never really putting the two of them in a deck. They're never really competing for the same spot, right? Radagast is great in an Eagle deck, and Treebeard is going to be great in an Ent deck, and you're probably never going to make an Eagle Ent deck. So you kind of have to look at the
challenge
two.
Accepted.
I mean, you probably could, because there's a couple. There's the what the tactics Ent, but yeah, I mean, they're very different cards in terms of what decks they're going into. And that's something that we definitely look at.
And traits get into that as well, because you mentioned Veteran Axe Hand, and by himself he's pretty wimpy, but in a dwarf deck he can be pretty stout. Same thing with the Galathon Archer. You mentioned her one hit point, but when you know you factor in the bonuses of Celeborn and things like that, it alters the card so much that this changes the way you can think about it.
It also it's not just the traits, but also within the mechanics of that one card. Like the Veteran Axe Hand's a guy that you want to stay on the table. So his extra hit point is really nice in that regard. The archer is someone that you want to bounce back and forth, so she enables different combos, very different play style as the Veteran Axe Hand. It may not seem like a lot, but that extra hit point can go a long way sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mentioned Celeborn. Let's talk about heroes for a little bit and how they've changed. And one of the things that I'm picking up on as you're talking is each cycle, and thusly the game as a whole, player cards and quests and encounter cards, some are going to be really good or really difficult in the case of encounter cards, and some are just going to be less so based on their context. And heroes seem to follow that pattern as well. So if we had Dine at Ironfoot at the end of the Shadows of Mirkwood cycle, who's everybody seems to consistently say is at least a little bit overpowered, we had Glorfindel in the middle of the Dwaradelph cycle, who's still the everybody's golden boy. Are the design factors for heroes any different than other cards, I guess, in terms of their kind of power level on whatever scale that you put them on? Or maybe a better question is, has there ever been a hero that you designed that just broke the game and you had to just scrap him immediately or just change his or her abilities?
Well, I mentioned earlier how every player card goes through multiple iterations, and I think that's never more true than with heroes, because they create such an impact on deck building more than anything. Like a single new hero can really change the meta of the game a lot. So the trick is to make each hero tap into a different play style and sort of encourage that play style in a way that's really fun and different, but also not game breaking. And that's something that we always have to, I mean, I tend to start out on the powerful end and then scale back because I just want them to be very fun. So an example would be someone like Idrien, who's actually probably the only hero I made in that cycle. I only made a couple of the heroes in that cycle, but probably the only one that really didn't change much in playtesting. She kind of just, that ability went onto the card and stayed on that card for a really long time. So Idrien, you read the ability and you immediately think, oh man, I want to build a deck where I explore locations. Yeah. Just over and over and over again to get the most use out of her ability. And that's not something that maybe you built a location control deck before out of necessity, but you've never been that encouraged to build a location control deck just because you had that one card that said to.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Mablung's another good example of that, that sort of design philosophy.
Mablung's a good example of a hero that I've been using more lately, I think, as a way to kind of combat the fatigue. Is I've noticed that if I go with... And by the way, I really like your suggestion earlier of just deconstructing your decks and making new ones every once in a while, because I've noticed that I tend to have some like top tier decks that I can go to that, especially solo, I can tend to crush a lot of scenarios with it, and maybe even just making you know, either no tweaks at all or minor tweaks. And that's, I think, another thing that can lead to fatigue, is just kind of that, well, if I feel like in solo, it's, you know, depending on the scenario, it can kind of be too easy, and then I feel like in multiplayer, it can be, some of the scenarios more lately can be too hard, then, like, where is that sweet middle ground? And the thing that I've found that is really great for that is to have a constraint of using traits, right? To say, like, I'm going to make a Gondor deck, even though this deck might be stronger if I mix and match, but I'm going to stick really strictly to Gondor. And Mablung's a great example where Gondor didn't get a huge boost in this cycle, but I think where the areas where it did get support are there's some really good cards. Mablung, Ithilien Lookout's another card I really, really like from this cycle. And so it's fun to be able to go back now that the card pool's at a certain size and say, I'm going to make like a dedicated Gondor deck. And it might not be, you know, top tier, so to speak, but it can still be effective and really a lot of fun to play.
Yeah. That's cool to hear. You know, I'm going to rant about Mablung for a second, because I love Mablung. I think he's a great example also of what I was saying before, between like the synergy between the sphere and the traits, where like Gondor has this theme of wanting resources, which we see both in their heroes and like Boromir, but also in their individual cards like Gondorian Fire and Blood of Numenor. And Tactics wants to engage enemies, so it just seemed like such a perfect marriage to put those two effects together.
Yeah, that's a great example of what you're talking about.
One of the things that I, you know, that seems different from this game just because of its cooperative nature and, you know, that people remark upon is just the fact that players do have that choice. So when you do have an overpowered hero like Dane or Glorfindel, which I would probably consider both on the overpowered side, in other games, the key to combat that would probably be restricting the options, banning them, whatever. But in this game, a lot of times, the design solution seems to be to add more options so that players have alternatives to using them rather than, you know, just errating or banning heroes outright. Like, Galadriel, for example, is kind of a... Even though it seems strange to say, she's kind of an alternative to Glorfindel. Even though they're very different heroes, their ways of managing threat and building, like combining with other heroes that might raise your threat to kind of, even though you might start off with a higher threat, you're keeping it lower over the course of the game. So yeah, I guess it's just a matter of, in both combating fatigue and, you know, heroes that may be a little bit more on the powerful side, then players might feel fatigue if they use them. It's just getting these more options over time, even if they come in really different forms.
I'm curious, Matt, to hear your take on heroes like Dane and Glorfindel. Like, how do you, you know, if, for example, you know, someone were to bring up a hero on that level for, like, the next cycle or one of the future cycles, what would you, like, would that immediately be looked at and people would say, oh, that's too powerful, or?
Just in terms of the global boost sort of ability?
Yeah.
I think it's something that we've been trying to avoid more of, and not because of its power level, but I think more because of the impact that it has on the meta in terms of, like, Dane, you see his ability, and you immediately build an all-dwarf deck extravaganza, and it's very powerful, and that's okay. We don't mind that it's very powerful. We mind more in its ability to sort of dominate deck lists for that, you know, for any length of time. Yeah. So when we designed someone like Celeborn and Galadriel to an extent, we wanted to make sure that they did synergize in the way that we wanted them to. Like, we wanted Celeborn to feel like the leader of the Sylvan Elves, but we didn't want his ability to be so in your face that you immediately said, okay, the way to beat these quests is to build Sylvan and all be all.
Interesting.
It's also, I think, a matter of how interesting the ability is in a sort of tactical way. Like Celeborn feels very tactical, and you have to really use his ability intelligently to get the best out of it. Whereas Dane is basically, if you don't exhaust Dane, you're good.
Yeah.
That's pretty much
yeah.
it. I mean, there's some strategy in there because you have to make sure that he's ready, and there are, you know, encounter cards that can exhaust him and that sort of thing. But for the most part, he's kind of one and done.
Yeah.
So that's not to say that he's... I still think that he's a great design. I don't think that he's... an errata is really necessary for him, because even though he's very powerful, there are definitely ways around his ability, ways that we can design around his ability. And I think he makes such a huge impact on the meta that we wouldn't want to necessarily alter that too much, because he's very widely used.
Yeah, since we're on the subject of errata, I guess we can kind of talk about both as players and from the design perspective, like, when do we think, where is that line between, you know, this card should receive errata and, you know, this card should just be left to players to kind of police themselves if they want to use it or not? Like, you know, just how do we draw that line so that there's not a ton of errata or some cards that just break the game?
Errata is a tough subject. I will say that the easiest errata for us to make is when we're trying to make cards more clear and sort of improve the way that they inform the player what they actually mean. And the easiest errata for us to make is the one that makes a card function the way that we intended it to, which doesn't happen all too often because we usually get it right, but every now and then it's necessary just based on the wording that is used to improve upon that to make sure that players always know when they read a card what it means. As far as power level goes, we'll try to errata a card when it's best for the health of the game, and when it's doing something that we just don't want it to do. Like the Blue Mountain Trader is probably the best example of that, where it's not necessarily that its effect was too powerful so much as it was restricting our future design space. And if we wanted to print a card that basically said everybody moves their resources around, we didn't want it to be that card. And it's not really what he was meant to do. He was meant to just move from one player to another and provide an interesting way of moving resources from one player to another, but not necessarily, you know, provide a resource match all the time forever till the end of time.
Yeah, it's kind of, I've gone back and forth between the two camps of, like, you know, errata anything that's like too powered and just let players police themselves. This is a cooperative game, and kind of evolved over time. But I think one of the things I think about with errata is it's a hard concept to kind of fully like tease out what it means, but like the integrity of the game, like if there's a combo that's like just lets you draw your whole deck and just do this endless loops, like even though it's a cooperative game and even though players can choose not to use that, there's a weird sense that I have that somehow that compromises the integrity of the game, that there's a way to just circumvent the rules, you know, and for me that's a case where like errata should step in.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Infinite combos is something that I think it's really interesting when they pop up, and I think that players go through a lot of lengths to find them, and it's really fun to find them. And I get that, but, and you know, if players want to just continue playing that way, there's nothing that we can do obviously to stop them, but I think that it's important that the game is never trivialized by a player deck.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me is, one, that most of the cards that get errata are cards I never use, or I don't use them in that way, probably because, again, it's mostly the tricksy stuff, like Zigil Miner. I mean, if whenever I used him, it was simply because I needed a cheap Spirit Dwarf, and never once for his ability, or you know, things like that. The Blue Mountain Trader, again, a card I'd probably never really use, and if I did, I don't have the patience to pass him back and forth 50 times to rearrange my resources. But I think in other games,
or the generosity, Matthew. Don't forget that.
Hey, I use Aaron Ryder all the time. I will share the wealth because I want to play Stewart and Horn in the same deck and play both. But I will. What was I going to say? Oh, just that. And I think a lot of other games, you don't necessarily have to errata anything. I mean, lots of games do, but you could simply design another card to counter your opponent's card. So if Dane was a card that was overpowered, then the next pack, the next expansion, the next whatever, would simply have the anti-Dane card that everyone could use, thus sort of nerfing Dane without the need for errata. But in this game, it's the encounter deck that reacts to us, But we talked about this on the show where I still think unlimited hand sizes to me is kind of an issue with the game. And while this cycle addressed it, it's gone once we get to the Lost Realms, right? As far as I know, that the hand size stuff won't be the theme or attacking hand size. So we have sort of patchwork fixes more so to some of the problems in the games, as opposed to, you know, again, if there was a competitive game and the anti-Dane card came out, well, then Dane is, for all intents and purposes, limited in his usefulness, as opposed to the sort of fixes we can do here, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's pros and cons on our side of the game being cooperative, because in a competitive game, it's, I would say, far, far more important to make sure that every card is as balanced as it can be, to make sure that not only is it a healthy, a healthy meta, but to make sure that people aren't just using one deck over and over and over again, which is something that we don't really have to necessarily worry about. Obviously, I'd like it if everyone used as many diverse decks as they could, but we don't have really tournaments per se in which we're, you know, keeping track of hundreds and hundreds of players who are all showing up with different decks. So, but at the same time, like you said, we also can't create an answer card for the encounter deck. We can toy around with different strategies like we have with the Dunlendings, and with other things too. Like effects that, for example, say all right. of your guys are blank is a great way of just saying, oh, are you playing Outlands?
Outlands until that card came up.
But at the same time, that's only in that scenario or maybe in that encounter set. So you can just avoid that if that's the deck that you really want to play, or just play around it. Obviously, if this were a competitive game and Dane were an issue, the first thing that we would do is create a card for, you know, the other side that said exhaust a hero, and that would really,
right,
that would just solve the issue. But we don't really have that liberty, so it's tough. I also find it tough because I come from a video game background, actually, not as a developer or anything, but I play a lot of video games, and they have the ease of being able to just patch the game.
Yeah, right.
They can just go in and say, oh, this card costs two now. And sometimes that's all you need to do. And then, you know, a little patch note pops up at the beginning of the game when you turn it on, and then you're done. But errata is something that's really tough as a player, as a customer, to say, I bought this card and now it's not what it says. And so ideally, we don't want errata at all. You know, ideally, we want a game with no errata, because then when a customer buys the product, they know what they're getting and they get what they have. And that's it. That's all there is to it. They don't have to go looking for the errata. So we try our best to not errata, and when we do issue an errata, it's after days and days of discussion and seeing if there's other things that we can do first before we arrive at the conclusion that we arrive to.
I will say that it is easy for, I'm just amazed that there's not more mistakes in the cards, if that makes sense, given how many there are and all the interactions, like, in creating my own, you know, expansion, I actually had quite a few people look through it and proofread, and there were still things that crept through, like big things like, oh, I forgot to put limit once per phase. That's kind of completely broken. So, yeah, I'm actually surprised that there's not more errata that has to be released, just given, you know, how many cards come out and how much text there is and just all the interaction. So,
yeah, I chalk that up to our playtesters. They're really good at spotting those kinds of things.
It's always fun when stuff creeps through, like the forums. Like there was the boon card, or one of the Gandalf's sword, where it didn't say attached to a hero or Gandalf. It just said whatever it said. So everyone's like, oh, we must be getting a Gandalf hero. And it was really just a typo on the card. But things like that are always fun. Or I remember noticing that in one of the articles that spoiled Nalir, it didn't call him an objective ally, just said objective. And I remember sending Caleb an email. I was like, I don't mean this to sound like I'm being a total jerk, but it doesn't say ally, and this is the first time it's not upset objective ally. He's like, nope, it's just a typo, you know, it'll be fixed when the card gets printed. But yeah, I always find those little mistakes that make it into articles kind of fun.
Sometimes those are not usually reactionary. A lot of times we will have sort of earlier versions of the card, like before they go through our many, many stages of approval that we go through, which, you know, are great because they spot a lot of these things. And sometimes we'll change a card long before an article goes up, but when the article goes up, it's using an older version of a card. And it doesn't happen all too often, but when it does happen, sometimes that's what it is. Like Nalir, I think, was one of those where we had already changed it.
Well, we've been talking about the Ringmaker cycle and how it's affected some of the older cards in the life of the game and how they've evolved over time. One thing we wanted to ask Matt, what is your favorite, maybe quote-unquote, under-the-radar card that you designed for the Ringmaker cycle that maybe not a lot of people know about or something along those lines?
Mirkwood Pioneer?
The Mirkwood Pioneer? So before the episode started, I defended the Mirkwood.
I liked your defense. Well. I thought it was good.
Well, I can reiterate it if you want, but because I would say that he didn't go under the radar. I would say he was very much
on the wrong
the
side of the radar.
As people picked him apart. I guess I would say the Mirkwood Pioneer, the best comparison to make is with the Escort to Aetheros card, because that's a 2-cost spirit ally. You really only play him for questing. You don't play him for anything else. And he quests once for 4 willpower, and then he's gone, right? And people love that card. He's a great card, and I think that's the best comparison to make for this card, because when you play the Mirkwood Pioneer, you're not playing him unless there's something in the staging area that's at least 3 or 4 threat. You could do something with 2 threat card, but it's not as big of a deal. It's the same thing when you have like Secret Paths or Radagast's Cunning. You're going to wait until you have the best moment to play it. So when you play this card, let's say there's a 4 threat location in the staging area, he's effectively questing for 5 on the turn that he enters play, and then he stays in play, and you can use him as a 1 willpower questing guy, or you can chump block with him. And the doomed cost is kind of incidental. In a 4-player game, it can be sort of a hassle, but doomed 1 isn't that big of a deal. And it can even be a benefit when you're playing cards like Keys of Orthanc and the sort of Grima doomed deck. So I think that he's actually a better card than people give him credit for. Other under-the-radar cards, I think one of my favorite cards from that cycle is Free to Choose, where you, after the encounter deck raises your threat, you lower your threat by an equal amount. I think that that's a great card. And we slotted it as a sort of tool belt card, meaning a card that you would just sort of have in your arsenal and put in when you need it, kind of like a sideboard card. Mm-hmm. If a quest has a bad effect that's raising raising your threat a lot, you'll throw this card in. But I think, honestly, there's very few quests that don't raise your threat at some point. So it's just a good card to throw in, really, in any spirit deck, especially if you're playing solo, because he's only lowering your threat. I don't know why I keep saying he.
Frodo or Frodo-ish person on there.
Yeah. But even, you know, even just in any spirit deck, I would put a copy or two in, just because I think every now and then you're going to run into an encounter card that raises your threat by 7, and this is a great answer to that.
Yeah, there's that annoying Doomed 3 card, and then you draw 3 cards, which is fun, but... in Antlered Crown, but man, that Doom 3.
And maybe you draw into your Free to Choose.
We hit it twice in a row yesterday, and I was like, oh my god, Doom 6? It was nasty. Yeah.
That was one of the fun things about going back and playing Watcher in the Water, is I'd forgotten about, it's something Waters, I can't remember the name.
Disturbed Waters.
Disturbed Waters, thank you. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's a Doom 5 card in this set. I'd totally forgotten about that. Like, that is brutal. I got like 2 in a row, and I was just, you know, because I was playing two-handed, and it's like, wow, everyone raises their threat by 10. That's a thing.
Oh, yeah. There's worse ones. I mean, if you go back and you play Conflict of the Carrick, and then you have the Frightened Beast card, and it's raising your threat by, if you're playing a 2 or 3, 4-player game, it's raising your threat by like 12, 13.
Yeah. Let me just say that many Vassals of the Windlord have been sacrificed in the name of that card.
A frightened vassal. Bill.
I just want to give a shout out to the unique attachments in that cycle. They're not under the radar because I think a lot of people saw their value, but they're some of my favorite designs from that cycle. Wingfoot, The Day is Rising, Heir of Mardial. Those are all cards that are very, very dear to me because I think that they're some of my favorite designs. Good cards.
We're going to wrap things up with our fun segment, and Matt, we're going to give you a free pass as you are our guest and you are under certain restrictions. But our fun segment for this episode is, if you had a magic wand and you were able to redesign one element of the game in the past, be it a player card or scenario or basically whatever you want, what would it be? I'm going to start by saying Bilbo. Knowing what we know now about the potential for hobbits and the way that you guys so wonderfully reframed them with the Black Riders box, I would love to see Bilbo with either better stats or I would say the same stats, or maybe even better stats, but lower threat, because I want to include him in more of the hobbit decks, but his high-ish threat for a hobbit sometimes mitigates the ability to use a lot of the secrecy and low threat stuff that I like to use in my Hobbit decks. And Bilbo is so wonderful, and his passive ability is so very good. And I know I sound like a broken record, but I would love to have Bilbo at least with a 6 or 7 threat. I think that would make him a lot more useful and see a lot more usage out of him in the current meta.
Maybe we'll get a tactics version in a few years.
That sounds like Bilbo. Tactics version. Tactics call him the Peter Jackson version.
Yes, yes. Complete with sting. Built-in sting.
Oh, that's so wrong. You're lucky you didn't join. You didn't join us for an episode to talk about the Hobbit movies, Matt, because that would have been,
would have been unpleasant.
Oh boy, you know, I saw online someone recut the entire trilogy into 4 hours. I haven't watched it, so I don't know, but
could be good.
It's interesting.
All right, Ian, what's your magic wand moment?
That's a tough one. I guess. The first one that pops into my head isn't really original because other people have suggested this, but I think it would be to have Spirit Glorfindel and Light of Valinor as is, except for Glorfindel would still raise threat just for committing
threat. Yeah, even though he didn't exhaust.
So you'd get the action advantage, but you would still have to raise your threat, and that would kind of compensate for his lower threat.
Dan?
This is hard. I think, I love the Middle-earth CCG, and one of the things I really liked about it is the way that locations, like your choice of going from one location to the next, affected what could be played against you. And I think if I had a magic wand, there would be something around like the active location having like a more direct effect on the way a lot of the treacheries worked or something. And I know that's very amorphous, but this is magic wand, so I can do whatever I want. It's my magic wand. But I think it would be really interesting to have, and who knows, maybe that'll be something that the designers can think about in the future, but just this idea that depending on where you are, that's going to have, it's going to change the context of some of the bad things that are happening.
Yeah, that whatever. Could definitely make quests more replayable. So, for example, a treachery, and it make treachery cards more complicated. But, you know, if you're at a forest location, it does this. If you're at a river location, this treachery does that. It could be cool, but it also makes card text really, really long. But it sounds neat.
Yeah. Well, that's for the designers to worry
that's
about.
True. I mean, you know, it's my magic
wand. I just get to come up with the fun ideas. I don't have to worry
right.
about
it. But, I mean, we did see on the player card that cloak, Lorien cloak, whatever it's called. You know, if you're at a forest, you get +1, whatever.
Yeah.
And we've had it with some of the locations, like, you know, if this is active, trolls get this. But never cards that are variable based on what is the active location. I think that's actually kind of a neat idea.
Yeah. I really like that cloak, by the way. So I don't know if you designed it, Matt, but kudos to whoever designed that one. It's a good
just
color.
Take credit for it. No one will know.
I would say, yeah, it was me.
Well, I guess Caleb will know.
Make work a little tense.
Yeah.
I think the majority of our card designs are sort of a joint effort. I think that, if I remember correctly, and I might not remember spot on, so Caleb will hit me if I'm wrong. No, he won't. But I think that was one of those cards where we wanted a sort of a defense boosting card. And I was like, oh, you know, it'd be nice if we played into the forest trait, similar to how dwarves have some stuff that boosts them when they're underground. And we didn't want to do too much of it, but we knew that we were also going to always kind of have forests. Like, we're never not going to be in a forest at some point.
Right.
So, it was a good, sort of good design there, I think. I hope.
Cool.
Since you brought up Middle-earth CCG, Dan, I'm going to totally take this chance to change my answer because I can't believe... My original answer, which I've always said, is I really want... I loved how there were corruption checks in the Middle-earth CCG, and, you know, everyone knows I'm a big fan of corruption, not in real life.
But, politics.
But in Tolkien's works and that whole theme. So it's kind of explored through threat in this game, but it'd be cool to have more of a...
What's the treachery that turns an ally against you? Oh, that's knife in the back. That's not quite corruption. What is Lure of the Ring?
Like the
isn't that a card?
Lure of the Ring,
what does that do?
I think
ring.
It's Fallen to Evil, isn't it? In the
Fallen to Evil is the one that turns a hero into
I like that one.
And then if I remember correctly, Lure of the Ring makes you raise your threat or exhaust the one ring.
Oh, no, that's okay, that doesn't really do corruption. But yeah, the Fallen, the hero one.
All right, Matthew, what's your...
You know, I don't really know. I mean, the answer probably Evan would expect me to have is the hand size thing, which, you know, I really don't play with a bunch of... My play group, that isn't an issue. I've just seen that's what breaks, you know, people drawing their deck in a turn. So it's, I can't think of anything else. I was going to mention the Glorfindel thing, but that's also not original. So if I could just go back, you know, hand size of 7, you discard down to 7 if you're over it. But
or make all lore cards tactics.
yeah, but then tactics would have a lot of crappy cards in it, so I don't want that.
Oh, Dormant has been thrown down.
That was harsh. Just kidding, just kidding.
Matt Newman, thank you so much for being on the show, man. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's really great to be on. And anytime that you guys want me on again, just, you know, throw me a ring.
You heard it here first.
We got our bribes. Awesome.
We will definitely be taking you up on that.
All right, Ian, you want to wrap this one up?
All right. So thanks for listening to a very special episode 21, and brought to you as always by our patrons. And this time, a special thank you to Nate and Lydia, who are our latest patrons. So if you like what we do on the show, if you like what you're hearing, and you want to support us with a few bucks, a few pennies, loose change, lint, you can head to patreon.com/grayco to become a patron. You get access to our newsletter where we throw in cool deck ideas, random thoughts, and receive other exclusive goodies. Other than that, you can check us out online at greatcompanypodcast.com. You can email us at thegreatcompanypodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter @thegreatco and find us on Facebook. Other than that, we'll see you next time and have a good night.
Good night,
everybody.
I want to add an option on Patreon for baked goods.
What, to send you baked goods?
Yeah. There'll be a lot of, put you at like the mid-tier level of patron if you just send us like a banana bread every month.
Yeah. I'll accept that.
What if I send you just the bottom of a muffin?
You're taking the muffin top?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's harsh.
Yeah, all right. You're in.
Ah, good. I'll just send Derek some coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, but wait a second. Is it a Game Center muffin?
I mean, it could be.
Oh, there you go.
But when I send you coffee, it's not going to be coffee beans. It's just going to be, you know, a mug of coffee that's spilled over, and when you open it, it spills over onto your lap, and it's somehow still hot, and you're not really sure how.
Oh, that's perfect, because then I could just be like, "Noom."
Nice.
Yes.